Call the Joint Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on Natural Resources to order for March 8th, 2017. And we have a public hearing that we're continuing for the Department of Environmental Quality on SB 5518. So I think we will continue that. Up to you. Oh, there you go. Okay. Portland Harbor already?
It's the last slide.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members for the record, Richard Whitman, the Director of the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. With your indulgence, I would like to actually start at the end of the land program here, which is Portland Harbor. In part, I want to do that recognizing what Co-Chair Witt said yesterday about keeping everybody awake. I thought this item might be calculated to do that. So the real reason, though, is I have the governor's policy advisor on Portland Harbor is with me today, Jim McKenna, to my left. And so he's available to participate in part of the program. But with your indulgence, I'd like to do that and then get him out of here and on to working on his task on Portland Harbor. So let me introduce this very briefly. I think everybody's aware that we have a very large federal Superfund site in the lower part of the Willamette River. And the site was first designated as a Superfund site by the Environmental Protection Agency back in 2000. So it has been a 16-year process working with EPA and the federal government to get through the planning stages of the Superfund cleanup and to the point where we are ready to actually start the cleanup itself and most importantly, returning the land, much of which is industrial, good, job-creating land to productive use. So DEQ has been working hard with EPA throughout this process. The way the responsibilities are lined out, DEQ has responsibility for the upland lands in and around Portland Harbor. EPA is the lead for the in-water work. DEQ will have a continuing role in the cleanup, a regulatory role in terms of oversight of cleanup working with the Environmental Protection Agency. But the state wears a number of hats here with regard to the harbor. And so the state also will be participating in the cleanup as one of the performing parties. And there's also involvement by Oregon Fish and Wildlife, as well as the Marine Board and several other agencies in the harbor. So Jim McKenna was hired by Governor Brown to really lead and jumpstart the work on cleaning up the harbor. And so I'm the regulator and he's the performing party, and that's the division of labor between the two of us. So with that, we do have a package in DEQ's budget related to the cleanup, and Jim's going to speak to it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Frederick, Chair Witt, committee, Portland Harbor, Richard's got a figure up here on the board showing Portland Harbor, which basically runs from the Broadway Bridge downstream to close to the Columbia River confluence, right about where Sabe Island is. As you see on the board, the red areas are the sediment locations where EPA has identified in their record of decision that active remedy will take place in
Could
the
water. You please introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Jim McKenna, Governor's Natural Resource Office.
Thank you. Thank
you. First time testifying, so I apologize.
It's all right.
The red areas represent the areas in the record of decision that EPA has identified will require active remediation. Active remediation being dredging, capping, and or some enhanced monitor natural recovery, in situ treatment, any type of active remedy. The areas in blue along the shorelines are banks that EPA anticipates having to do some cleanup work along the banks. So as you see, there's quite a few areas of the river that need to be addressed. We're looking at the very first step post-ROD, doing some harbor-wide baseline sampling. EPA has identified the need for that because a lot of the data that was collected, as Richard Whitman mentioned, the study's been going on for about 15, 16 years. A lot of the data is rather old. It's older than 10 years. So we need to go out and do a new baseline sampling. It's a very dynamic river, energetic river, and conditions may have changed a bit over the last 10 years. So the baseline sampling throughout the harbor will help identify whether or not these red areas are still the same size or not. Another portion of the post-ROD sampling effort will be to go to some of these key sites and do detailed sampling around those areas to help support the final design for cleanup at a particular area. So what we're looking for in the $10 million budget is to partner with a couple other responsible parties, both public and private parties, to cost share on the harbor-wide baseline sampling, and then to also partner with a couple parties to identify one or two key locations to do the detailed design sampling.
I might suggest that you take a look at that picture rather closely.
Mm-hmm.
That is not an uncommon sight to have someone fishing. Notice the, what they've got their fishing pole in. Anchored in a tire there, and the other pardon?
Where's the rest of the car? It corroded.
It's in the it's under the water right there. This is there are parts in that map that you saw just before that the Portland Harbor that Representative Whitten I know pretty well because his district is on the south, on the lower part of that of the river there, and mine is on the northern part of the river. Thank you.
So any questions for Mr. McKenna before he takes off?
You mentioned, if you could, any other questions? Yes.
I'll ask
mine after.
We've been 16, 17 years into this project, and now we have to go back and redo it because of our not getting it done in the first place. I mean, where does that line stop?
So, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, we're at the stage in the cleanup process, which is called remedial design. So the normal course here is after you have all your planning work done to then focus on specific parts of the cleanup site and do the final, really engineering level design work to identify exactly what type of cleanup will be required, where, what materials, cost the whole thing. So that's the site-specific work that will be done here in this next phase. And then the harbor-wide sampling that Mr. McKenna alluded to is really for monitoring the results of the cleanup and for documenting to everybody that we've gotten to the cleanup levels that have been set in the decision.
Paul?
Yes, go ahead.
So how long will this take, and will we have to go back for the other stuff that's been over 10 years more so after we're done with this part?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, it's expected that this next round of sampling will take at least a couple of years, frankly, probably go on a little longer than that for certain specific areas. But the overall cleanup is a 13-year project after that two-year period. So total time, we're looking at another 15 years before we're done in Portland Harbor under this decision.
30 years.
Yes, Representative Webb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the fishing rod there, is part of that sampling fish tissue samples?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, yes. The sampling, the harbor-wide sampling in particular that will be done will be looking at sediment, water, and fish.
And
yes, go ahead.
And so do you sample the whole area or just the hot spots? I mean, those fish move around, I'm assuming, so.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, essentially you lay out on a statistical basis a grid for the sampling, and so that you can say with some certainty this is what contamination exists in particular parts of the cleanup area.
So how many samples would you be taking? Is there, do you know?
Sure. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, what we're looking at for the harbor-wide baseline sampling is likely, we haven't penciled it out with EPA yet or negotiated, but it's in the hundreds and hundreds of sediment samples harbor-wide. You would then do some transects, probably three or four areas where you do surface water sampling, and you would do that surface water sampling likely every quarter for a couple years. Mm-hmm. And then we're looking at fish tissue, and we're talking about resident fish, which are the smallmouth bass, will be the majority of the fish we investigate, and likely about 100 smallmouth bass. That actually pushes the limit of how many bass we can catch in any given year without putting a big dent in the bass population within the harbor for recreational fishing.
You should contact Tom Wolf for that, too. He's pretty good at that. Mm-hmm. Fishing thing. So will the
he's good at fishing, not catching anything. Huh?
Will the results be available to the public?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, yes, all this data will be available to the public. The work plan will be negotiated with the U.S. EPA. We will collect it under an EPA-approved sampling plan.
Uh-huh.
All the samples will go to an EPA-approved laboratory, and then the data will be available to all parties, both the performing parties, the PRPs associated with the harbor, and the public.
Thank you.
Thank you. A couple of things. You mentioned the involvement of, with other private groups in terms of cleanup. Would you speak to that? What other groups are we talking about? What other companies? How is that a part of this?
Yeah. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, we're in private negotiations right now with some of those parties. They're in Portland Harbor, EPA has identified 150 potential responsible parties for the contamination. Those 150 parties are both public entities and private. The publics include the state of Oregon through DSL and DOT, but it also includes the federal government through Army and Navy operations, shipbuilding, ship dismantling. And then a number, dozens and dozens of private parties. We're talking to a few of those, hoping literally within the next couple of weeks to have a team together that is agreeable to work forward and work with EPA to sign an order.
You are, I want to make sure this is understood. You're not talking about just one or two contaminants. You're talking about a range of industries that were right on the river. We built ships there. We painted ships there. We put chromium in certain areas and arsenic in other areas and lead in other areas. It's important to understand we're looking at a whole range. You said 100 other businesses or other groups. That's because we may have that many different kinds of contamination that we're talking about in this area, and trying to clean it up is going to be difficult. Yes.
I'm not sure you're aware of the three-basin rule, but the three-basin rule on the watersheds for Portland's water is set under a different set of requirements than Portland themselves. Have you thought about implementing the three-basin rule on the cities of Portland, Eugene, and Salem, who happen to be the major polluters?
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Frederick, Senator Sherrod, I am going to have staff look at the potential application of the three-basin rule in this circumstance. I'm familiar with it as it applies to Salem, actually. There's been some history there. But we'll have to have staff look into that as far as Portland and Portland Harbor goes.
Paul, go ahead. Yes.
I just happen to have a bill that addresses that issue.
I see.
And I have to tell you, in my district, it's pretty upsetting that we come under stronger environmental rules than what those three cities do, and they tend to ignore you know, the set of standards. And for example, in Staten, the sewer had to be a sequential batch reactor because we're on the North Santiam River, even though the discharge point was below Salem's intake point for their water. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a whole new ball of wax as you go up into these little watersheds, of which I represent most of them, that the big cities, they won't abide by the rules that they're putting on these other smaller cities.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that very much. I hope you'll take a look at that.
Yeah, we will. Thank you. Absolutely.
And you have somebody else coming up now?
I do. So I'd like to introduce Abby Buderis, who's a legislative analyst for the Department of Environmental Quality. And we're going to go back quickly to regular order here. And I'll kick it off. Okay. So, again, we are starting into the background on DEQ's three main programs, and they're going to go in this order: land, then air, then water. And so this next part of the presentation is on the land quality program. So the goal of the program is to ensure healthy places where Oregonians live, work, and play. And there are a number of different programs that are included within this program area. You wouldn't necessarily think of all these programs off the top of your heads. But first of all, in terms of emergency spills are within the land quality program, underground storage tanks, hazardous waste, and environmental cleanup. I'm going to talk about each of those in a little bit more detail in a moment. But first, I want to just give you a few numbers. I'm not going to go through all of these, but it's rather remarkable to see the number of leaking tanks that the program has dealt with over the last 15 to 30 years, depending on the program. We've got a lot of cleanup that has happened in the state. The other thing that really strikes me, and I'm still drinking from a fire hose a little bit, is director at DEQ, but the spill program. I want to talk about that for a second. 1,500 spills in 2016. We have a daily report, a daily log of spills that comes into my office and other managers in the agency. And they're, you know, typically we're seeing anywhere from 3 to 10 spills a day on that report. And many of those are tanker trucks or automobiles. It's really remarkable the number of spills that we have in the state. And the amount of work that goes on just sort of regular order responding to those spills and cleaning them up. This is a significant effort in the agency. So, of course, the biggest spill of all in the past year was the Mosier train derailment that you see the picture of here. And the couple of things of note here, that first of all, we were very fortunate just in the circumstances that occurred there. That incident really tested Oregon's spill response capabilities, both for the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office, Oregon Emergency Management, as well as DEQ. DEQ's responsibility in an incident like this is the spill response piece. The fire marshal has the lead responsibility in terms of life and safety protection response. We're still working on Mosier. In terms of the contamination from the oil in groundwater there, and we'll be overseeing work by Union Pacific there for some time. All right. So briefly on the underground storage tank program, I am going to transfer that over to Abby to take now for a moment here. Go ahead, Abby.
Thank you.
And introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Witt and Co-Chair Frederick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Abby Buderis, and I am a legislative analyst for the land quality programs at DEQ, and I will highlight a few of them for you today. Starting with the Underground Storage Tank, or UST program, that program is directed by both federal and state laws, and it works to prevent leaks from tanks, like those tanks at your local gas station. And those leaks can impact land, air, and water, especially groundwater. DEQ inspections and technical assistance helps ensure the proper functioning of those tank systems, and also that the tank owners have the proper financial coverage in place to clean up contamination and stay in business if a leak does occur. EPA requires that states inspect the tanks once every 3 years, but beginning in 2016, the DEQ funding for that program is only allowing us to afford to do once every 5 years. The graph you can see here, and no, it's not a regression analysis, I thought I might, but it shows compliance with tank regulations, and you can see Oregon compliance here in blue compared to the rest of the country. Oregon, it does do better with 85% compared to 74%. But a new EPA study did show that as you go from every three years to every 5 years inspections, compliance starts to drop between 7 and 10%. Next slide. So Package 132 will fund the two vacant inspector positions that are holding back our compliance rate, that are vacant due to lack of funding, and one policy position. These positions are supported by a fee increase that's included in a companion bill, HB 2268, which passed out of House Energy and Environment on Monday, and it should be on its way to you. Next slide. Switching to materials management is depicted by the circular diagram here, which shows the full life cycle of materials from resource extraction and production through consumption, use, and then recovery and disposal. The materials management program, which was previously called the solid waste program, you might be more familiar with that name, does a number of things. It regulates disposal sites like landfills and compost facilities. It oversees local compliance with state recycling standards and the state's producer responsibility programs for paint and electronics. Provides grants and technical assistance to support community-level efforts to reduce and recover waste and to collect household hazardous waste from the public. The program works with businesses and others to voluntarily reduce the impacts of materials. In short, the material management program works on garbage and on recycling, but also on reducing the impacts of materials throughout the life cycle. If you look at the bar graph, it shows the consumption-based greenhouse emissions by life cycle stage, so it matches up with that circular diagram. And you can see that most of the emissions are upstream in the production stage before the consumer. But that doesn't mean recycling and disposal isn't important, because in fact, you reduce greenhouse gas emissions when manufacturers use those materials that are recycled to make new products. So to look at some trends, materials management has long worked on and tracked materials management and generation of waste and continues to do so. At the end of the useful life of a product or material, it's generally either disposed or it's recovered through recycling or composting. And waste generation, as we call it, is the sum of disposal and recovery. So you can see the three lines there. Generation is important because all waste that's generated had to be reproduced in the first place and therefore had those upstream impact. So you can see here that we used to dispose of much more than we recovered, but those lines have now converged, and Oregon now actually recovers almost as much as it disposed, about half and half. Per capita generation, though, climbs steadily into the recession, which brought it down a bit. But it has started to climb again along with the economy. So to go to our KPM for the program, this is the existing KPM, although we are recommending changing it. It tracks pounds of municipal solid waste landfilled or incinerated per capita. We've met our target for the last several years, although it is increasing. So 1,300 pounds or so per person. We're proposing changing the KPM to reflect the statutory updates that were approved by the legislature in 2015. Senate Bill 263 established new statewide goals for both waste generation and waste recovery. We're proposing to replace those with two new measures, separating them out, generation and recovery. Those two measures parallel the two goals that were in the legislation back in 15. So now looking to POP 131, it would allow DEQ to build on the strategic planning and program development and implement the 2050 vision and framework for action that guides the materials management program. Revenue for that is from solid waste tipping fees that were authorized by this body in 2015, and they are sufficient to fund the additional positions and grants. The POP includes five positions and contracts and grants that work to implement the programs working with businesses to help them reduce their impacts of materials. Two of those are with the concrete industry and on food waste. It will allow us to partner with local governments and industry to improve recycling and reuse infrastructure and prevent food waste and other waste, and some additional policy and rule development. So finally, for me, on sort of the prevention side of the program, is our ballast water program. And that program works to prevent the release of aquatic invasive species to Oregon's waterways. It's a 1.6, so a pretty small program, but it plays a critical role in preventing the introduction of these aquatic invasive species, such as quagga or zebra mussels, to our waterways. The program is responsible for establishing and enforcing management practices that allow commercial vessels to operate and discharge ballast water without posing high risk for introducing these species, which, when they get introduced, can have serious both environmental, economic, and human health impacts. So without those prevention efforts, and those efforts include pre-arrival screening, inspection, and compliance verification, the establishment of and spread of these species could have irreversible and long-term impacts on our environment. And I will turn it over to Richard again.
Thanks, Abby. So Abby just went through some of the pollution prevention parts of the land quality program. I'm going to talk a little bit about the some of the main programs to react to problems once they've been created. So this slide shows the cleanup sites in the state of Oregon, including the confirmed release inventory, as well as a number of other inventories of contaminated sites. And the basic point here is that this is a pretty pervasive problem in terms of dealing with cleanup sites. On the good news side of the ledger, DEQ, one of the things it does working with private parties who are responsible for the contamination in each of these sites is to enter into what's called a prospective purchaser agreement. That essentially provides that if the party cleans the property up to the specifications that are set in the agreement, that DEQ will sign off on a no further action letter so that a future user purchaser of the site can be confident that they will not have liability for that past contamination that occurred. It frees up the property for reuse. So again, on KPMs, this is another area where the DEQ is proposing some changes in its KPMs. So I'll quickly go through the existing ones and then point you to the changes that we're proposing. The first KPM is the percent of hazardous waste sites that have been cleaned up. You'll see that we're right about at our performance objective on cleanup of overall sites. This is an overall number that combines a lot of different categories of sites, including leaking underground storage tanks as well as home heating tanks. So this next KPM, existing KPM, breaks out the cleaned up regulated tanks and heating oil tanks. And then we have another KPM that is just the hazardous waste sites. So part of the issue here is that, particularly with that first performance measure, you sort of lose any real information because it combines so many things. So what we're proposing to do is move to a new 5A, B, and C, which separates out each of those types of cleanup and provides a performance measure for each subcategory, which is much more meaningful information. Okay. Part of what we do also is, and this is related sometimes to prospective purchaser agreements, is cleaning up brownfield sites that have been essentially abandoned because of concerns about liability for cleaning up the contamination. We've got a number of major success stories around the state. Other agencies I'll mention have programs in brownfields. So Business Oregon has a brownfields program also that we work with. And local governments are interested in this, I know from my old experience, because these lands are a real source of renewal potentially in downtown areas, and then also typically industrial lands that can be in short supply.
If I may.
Yes.
One of the things that you might take a look at, and you will probably know exactly where those brownfields are in your districts. In the estimate for my House district, I had 147 of them.
Yeah.
For my Senate district, it's about 300. These are the small gas stations, the dry cleaners, the mechanic shops, the battery operator folks, the photography studios, or photography film processing places. A lot of these places have the contamination, and in many cases, folks do not want to take on those things because they don't know what's there, and they don't want to take on the liability. So this particular bill, which was we managed to pass in 2011. Mm-hmm. Really change that. And so you have these kinds of successes with the street fair and the commons and several others that you'll see coming up. But we still have a lot of those places that are already zoned industrial or commercial that are simply not being used. I remember talking with a couple of folks from Eastern Oregon, and the farm supply places where they had pesticides and herbicides that had been spilled or fuel needed to be cleaned up. They're often now sitting empty because there's no idea how to get them cleaned up. This is an important factor, and I think you'd find it in each one of your districts.
And so, Co-Chair Frederick, here's another one in Astoria, Garden of Surging Waves. Again, just a remarkable project that's brought vitality back to a downtown area. So related somewhat to the Brownfields program is the Orphan Sites program. This is the program where we can't find a responsible party. The former owner has typically gone bankrupt, and there's nobody there with assets to pay for the cleanup. Often this occurs in the context of a federal cleanup. And under the federal Superfund program, if federal money is being put into a site, there's a requirement for a state match, state cost share. This particular site is a fairly well-known one down in Klamath Falls. It's a former Army barracks outside of Klamath Falls that unfortunately a residential subdivision was built on top of it. And, you know, I don't know that anybody knew, but at the time the Army base was decommissioned, back in the 40s, it had asbestos siding and asbestos insulation, and so there was significant asbestos contamination that homes were put basically right on top of. So working with the federal government and the state orphan site program, this site is, we're right in the middle of it right now, slowly being taken care of and returned to productive use. So this takes us to the next package, which is a series of packages related to the orphan site. And this is essentially continuing the regular round of funding that DEQ seeks for the orphan site program through limitation and bonding. Okay. And I believe... yes, package 136. So the last slide for the land quality program is a policy package 136. This is a proposal for a fairly limited amount of general fund dollars to fund lead paint task force. We have we had correspondence from EPA a year ago pointing out certain deficiencies in Oregon's lead paint programs. Lead paint, this issue primarily comes up in the context of the Construction Contractors Board, which has a licensing program for lead paint abatement, and then also through the Oregon Health Authority, which does work on lead paint. DEQ's role is pretty limited with regard to lead paint. It's mainly around disposal of waste. But there are some potential gaps in terms of lead paint, both lead paint within existing homes, and then recently there's been quite a bit of concern about residential demolitions and lead paint. And so the idea here is to take a look and see whether we do have any serious gaps, and if so, what to do about them. Okay, with that, I'd like to transition to the air quality program, and I'd like to invite Dave Collier, who's the planning manager for the air program at DEQ, to come up and join me. Dave. So, Dave, go ahead and introduce yourself, and I think you're actually going to kick this off, if
right,
I remember correctly.
Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, committee, my name is David Collier, and I manage air quality planning for DEQ. Perhaps first slide up, right? Yeah. We face a number of different types of challenges in the air program, as you might expect, from meeting and preserving compliance with federal air quality health standards, some of the classic pollutants you may have heard of before, ozone and fine particulate, to reducing air toxics, that's a very emerging and complex field, to addressing greenhouse gas pollution, and also protecting air quality in our cherished scenic and wilderness areas around the state. And so I'll just be hitting a few highlights of our program as we go along. I'd like to start with a map that just is an overview of the areas where we've worked to meet federal air quality health standards over the decades, primarily in this map, ozone and fine particulate. This map shows areas around the state where we have solved non-attainment problems in communities and where we currently have them, and where we are currently working with communities to prevent violations of federal standards and avoid non-attainment designation under the Clean Air Act. And there's really, I think, three things I'd like to stress just about non-attainment under the Clean Air Act. The first, obvious, is that when we measure violations of the federal standards, we are seeing days where the air is just unhealthy for the public to breathe. But being designated non-attainment by EPA also has some pretty serious economic consequences for communities. Often it invokes more strict regulations on whatever local industry might be contributing to air quality in that community. And also just the stigma of being designated as a non-attainment area by EPA can put a damper on local economic development.
Just a second.
Sure.
I didn't mean to interrupt you in the middle, but I'm one to look at the map. Does the three colors signify anything?
Regions.
Well, I understand they're regions, but regions of what?
Good question. Yeah, so Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Girod, the three colors are the three main regions for DEQ's regions, so Northwest, Western, and Eastern region.
Thank you.
Yep. Right. Thanks for that. We should have that.
Since we have that interruption, I'm looking at Burns going, what? What is the issue there in Burns?
Burns is one of those communities, I think similar to Hillsboro or some other places where we have measured some high levels of fine particulate, but they're not high enough to be violating standards, but they're an area where we are monitoring and paying attention to.
If I could, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, I think The issues in communities like Burns, Lakeview, also Klamath Falls, a lot of that typically has to do with wood smoke.
Wood smoke? Okay.
Yeah, right.
Just curious, yeah.
No, that's a great clarification. We'll talk about that in a second. But one of the chief drivers for violations and non-attainment around fine particulate standards is residential wood heating.
Yeah. Yes. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Burns, you know, every time I've been over there, the wind's blowing, so I'm not sure on that one. But I do know that they have an unusual amount of roads that are not paved, and that adds to your particulate level. I'm not sure if I agree with the wood stove, but I do know that there's a substantial number of unpaved streets coming off of the main streets in Burns that drive that particulate level up. 2.5 particulate level is pretty small, but I think that if they did more, if they had the ability to do more with their paving of their streets, it would help immensely for compliance.
Thank you. I'm just curious. I spent a lot of time over there, and there's an awful lot of wind, so I was just wondering where that was coming from.
That's
I was wondering also whether perhaps it was, I mean, they also have diatomaceous earth over there, and that may have some blowing off of the mines or just off the soil and the high desert stuff. So I just was curious about that.
Right.
That's all. Thank you.
Very good questions. Thank you. Well, I'm glad you raised these areas. We work very quickly when we have an area that's violating standards. We engage with the community, the elected officials, immediately to make a plan to bring their community back into compliance. But it's also extremely important for us to invest in working in communities when we see the start of a problem to avoid them actually violating standards and avoid going non-attainment. If you are designated non-attainment, it's basically been described as a 30-year date with EPA, and it's a date you don't want to go on. So not only restoring air quality in areas that have problems, but preventing those problems in the first place is a major part of our focus.
Yes. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Frederick. I just want to clarify, I represent Southeast Portland, and Director Whitman knows all about this. And so we, of course, have a lot of air quality issues, as in North Portland, especially in the last year, Northeast Portland.
Right.
And your work is really only possible, if I understand correctly, if it can be detected that there's a problem with air quality. Is that a correct statement? I mean, we have now learned that the air quality was not necessarily what we thought it was,
right.
For example. In the Portland metropolitan area, and especially in Southeast Portland.
Right.
And so I just want to...
If I could, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Taylor, I think what you may be getting at is just the limitations that the agency has in its ability to monitor. We are going to get to a fairly specific discussion about what monitoring capabilities we currently have and what monitoring capabilities we are seeking, and we will be also talking about what we can do in terms of modeling, which is the other response to your question, to predict where there might be air quality problems.
There you'll see a little bit further on some discussion of that. So
okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tell me about the ozone. I'm kind of confused. What is the detrimental to the ozone?
Sure. Co-Chair Frederick and Co-Chair Witten Committee, ozone is a different type of air pollutant with its own unique health effects. So just think of it as smog, essentially. And at high concentrations, at high levels over the standard, it can irritate people's lungs. It can put pressure on people's respiratory and heart systems. So it's just one of the pollutants we have been in violation of in the past in places like Portland and Medford. Right now, we're in compliance with the ozone standard. Our highest areas are still Portland and Medford. And interestingly, in Hermiston, we're starting to see some high levels of ozone. And we're thinking that has more to do with interstate transport along Oregon and Washington and Idaho. But it's a pollutant where we have strategies in place that are really helping us stay in compliance with the federal standard.
Follow up?
Yes, go ahead.
Is this something that's just come on in the last few years? Because I never remember 20 years ago we talked about the ozone.
We've had trouble with ozone over many decades, going back into the 70s and 80s. We've been in pretty good shape in the last few years, but again, I think because of the strategies we have in place over many years are sort of acting as our insurance now, providing us enough safety buffer that when EPA keeps lowering and making more protective the ozone standard as they did a few years ago, we're staying ahead of the curve and in compliance.
As a reporter, Representative Esquivel, when I covered looking at the ozone issues in the late 70s, early 80s, in both Portland and in Medford, because we've been having this as a concern for some time.
Right. Yeah, sure. So this next slide just gives you a quick look at, as an example, of particulate trends in one of our key rural areas, Klamath Falls, and we've been working with in that community for many, many years. Klamath Falls used to have one of the highest levels of particulate in the entire country, and the primary driver, as in many of our communities like this, have been wood stoves. But when we go into these communities, we do an assessment. We use our air monitoring to look at the chemistry of what we're seeing. Sometimes we'll use computer models. And in some communities, you will see other factors like road dust or industrial emissions contributing to the overall violations of the standard. Also, for fine particulate in particular, we tend to see the violations in the wintertime on days where we see very stagnant air. So it's not every day that the air is unhealthy. It's typically on a set of days where just the conditions are right or wrong to actually make air pollution levels exceed the standards. But this is a typical sort of picture for other communities that we've worked with around the state, like Eugene, Grants Pass, and Medford and LeGrand, and we've been very, very successful at bringing those areas back into compliance. One function that our strategies have today is really to help us avoid future violations when EPA from time to time lowers or makes more protective the federal health standards. And we've seen that happen over the years for both ozone and fine particulate, where EPA will make the standard tougher. And you can see that in this chart here, where in the initial years of the chart, and the standard is the red line at 65, all our existing strategies were really preventing us from having a problem. When EPA lowered the standard, we had a few problems, but we worked with the Klamath Falls community to correct that, and I'm happy to say they're back into compliance. Here's a similar trend, just real quickly, on Portland. As I said, Portland has a history of violating ozone standards and carbon monoxide standards, not so much fine particulate, and the trends have been improving. But in 2008, EPA lowered the fine particulate standard, and that's where we started seeing some problems in Washington County and in Hillsborough. And we worked with those folks immediately to get them doing some prevention planning, and they've done a wonderful job getting strategies in place, a wood stove education program, curtailment wood stove replacement program, and their quick action has really, I think, been amazing. And I think you can see that looks like that's working as well. Next slide. Another quick success story I just want to share with you briefly is the town of Oak Ridge in Lane County. Oak Ridge has been working for many, many years to bring their community back into compliance with standards, and in 2016 they were finally able to do it. They've met standards, and that's just a big success for Mayor Jim Corey and Merlin Huff and his staff at the Lane Regional Air Protection Districts. And so I just wanted to say they did a great job making that happen. Thanks. So I'm just going to touch briefly on the world of air toxics, which is an emerging and very complex field of air quality research and extremely important part of our public health protection work. Air toxics are made up of many, many chemicals, many different kinds, that are known or suspected to cause serious health problems like cancer, or nerve damage, or respiratory distress. And the sources of air toxics are many. They come from thousands of different types of sources, big and small, from industrial activity to cars and trucks and paints and solvents and just most modern human activity. So it's a complex area to get your head around. It takes a lot of research and study and measurement to know the story of what you're dealing with. The highest levels of air toxics tend to happen in larger communities because of their larger population and just more sources. But air toxics can have significant impacts at a local level or even a neighborhood scale, just kind of depending on what's going on in that area. And wood stoves is, again, another kind of example of a neighborhood scale source of air toxics. Wood stoves are a source of both fine particulate and also of air toxics. So to talk just a little bit more about, I think, our monitoring and assessment and how we learn what we need to learn, I think I'm going to turn that over to Brian Bowling.
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Brian Bowling. I'm a laboratory program manager for the Department of Environmental Quality. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about air toxics and how, as a state and as an agency, we go about monitoring air toxics. As David talked earlier, there's many different sources of air toxics. Compounds, there's thousands of air toxic compounds that can be looked for. For DEQ, we have a number of different ways we look for air toxics and a number of different monitoring styles that we look for these air toxics. Excuse me. Next slide. When we look for air toxics, what we're looking for is really what's impacting human health. And in this chart here, we're looking at what compounds we found that were over the ambient quality benchmark. And so you can kind of consider this as the health impact number is 1, and we see 2. We get a factor of what's called 2 on this chart. And what this is, it allows us to look at different groups of compounds and how far they are over our health targets or those ambient benchmarks. So as you can see in this chart, there's a number of different categories of compounds we look for, and we have issues around volatiles, metals, carbonyls, naphthalenes, which are your and PAHs, which are your combustion products. All of these being above our health targets, and when you look at this as a total, you can kind of consider that, you know, a 40 is a lot worse than the 20 over time. The change over time allows us to kind of track, and this is the trend in air toxics. Then we drill down a little bit, and we get into more detail about the individual compounds that we're finding. So in the case there, the volatiles was that gray bar. Benzene is one of those. And when we look at this chart here, you can see the health benchmark for benzene is 0.13. And all of our measurements for our two trend sites have all been above that health target that we have. This allows us to, though, look at trends. It allows us to see that we're making improvement over time and where our benzene levels are going down, but we're still not meeting our goal and our target of that health benchmark. What you don't see on this chart is the individual sites, those annual sites that I talk about, where we rotate them around. They'd be an individual dot on a particular year, and it's a snapshot in time. Again, these are our trend sites, so we get that trend over time versus the individual snapshots when we, say, put up a monitor in Gresham for a year. It can only tell us for that year it was over the benchmark or not. It doesn't tell us how well we're doing improving.
Would you speak to where benzene is coming from?
Benzene comes from combustion. It comes from our vehicles, smoke, things of that nature, plus industrial.
And the amount of one of our issues is how much benzene we're allowing to within our fuel as well.
Yep.
In Oregon versus what you might find in other places.
Yep.
So that helps, that has an impact on how much we're seeing as well.
And that's where you can kind of see in this chart, the benzene for Portland going down is in fuel improvements that we see, where you don't see that improvement in LeGrand is most, the source isn't necessarily the fuel as the only source.
Thank you.
Excellent. With all of this, we have a lot that we do to monitor air toxics. We have multitudes of ways we monitor air toxics. I talked about that yesterday. One of the things that with air toxics, though, it's very difficult to monitor air toxics. There's so many different compounds, so many different methods that have to be analyzed in order to monitor those air toxics. But we have to approach this through partnerships and new methodologies in being able to do this work. And the Moss study really was that partnership with DEQ and the Forest Service in allowing us to tackle something that we knew about. We knew that there was cadmium concentrations that we couldn't really explain in the Portland based on our PATS model and based on the monitoring we had done. It didn't make a lot of sense. We didn't know where those concentrations were coming from. And through working with U.S. Forest Service and their Moss study, we're able to target and see where those potential areas of concern were and follow that up with air monitoring and go in there with air monitors for metals, looking at true air concentration. Because as we know, what's in the Moss isn't what people are being impacted from a human health air inhalation pathway. It's what's deposited onto that Moss. Unless you eat a Moss sample or a Moss salad, you don't really have that exposure. But it does tell us areas that we should go in and look, that it's an area of interest, and that we should put the proper monitors in place to see if there is a concern of human health through inhalation. So through this partnership with U.S. Forest Service, we were able to do that. We followed up a number of areas with metals monitors, and we're actually continuing the Moss work. U.S. Forest Service has a number of studies they're undertaking, and we're actually, as the state, received some funding to take on Moss and do it ourselves so that we can target our expensive monitors into areas that we know there's a concern, and it's a great screening tool because it's inexpensive for the screening and then allows us to come back in with a more expensive technical way of doing the air monitoring.
As I look at that map, you obviously see some of the major places that people are concerned about in your district, in particular southeast and northeast as well, but also up near the airport. And we have a couple of, as I've discovered, bong manufacturers who because they're using glass and melting it, have some hot spots as well. How far along are we with looking at some of those other not obvious point sources for the metals that we're concerned about?
So right now we're going back doing our next round of sampling for the Moss. We're looking at some of those areas that we had higher levels of some of the metals and collecting Moss samples and be analyzing those. In some of the cases, and I'll use the bond manufacturers as an example, a lot of that cadmium, once it's in the glass, it actually doesn't come out of the glass. It's through the actual process of making the glass from raw materials that you get the cadmium release, but actually remelting the glass isn't necessarily the largest source or the source of those cadmium levels. But it's through that additional monitoring, going back and checking in some of these areas, we can understand, is that still a hot spot? Because that study was done 3 years ago, once it was kind of handed to us, and we don't know what had changed. And we went actually back in time through some of the Google Earth maps and looking at photographs of changes on the street. And there was entire strip malls that had been demolished and new ones put up in place between the time of the Moss sampling and today. And so the conditions are just really different. And so that's really going back with this Moss study to see what is it that we're seeing today. And then coming back in, if we do see something that's elevated, that is an area of interest, we come back in with the air monitors.
Senator, did you have something?
Thank you. Chair Federer, maybe you're going to cover this at some other point, but what I would like to see is some information about, and I don't want to put words in your mouth about lack of funding or why this is occurring, but it is my understanding from having more meetings than I can count that I have attended in my community and with various businesses and with DEQ and et cetera, about that there were not enough monitors, that there is not enough funding, there isn't we can't cover all these areas throughout the state, et cetera. And so I'm trying to also have it be brought out into the public and in this forum. And I know it's not generally how we handle things in Ways and Means in subcommittees, but in this case, because we are talking about human health and this has been such a significant issue, it's not just in Southeast and Northeast Portland, but now we're learning about different areas throughout the state, where the gaps are and what the plan is, or if there's not enough funding, or having this all out in the public light is what I'm looking for. Maybe it can't be answered here today with the slides you have, so I'm not asking you to put it on the spot at this moment, but there seems to be a gap in finding out where the problems are, studying it adequately, or potentially there's a gap. And if there isn't, then of course correct me, but and I appreciate you're going to use modeling and et cetera, but I'm concerned going forward, not that DEQ doesn't know what it's doing, but it just isn't necessarily set up to be able to address the issue to everyone's satisfaction. So I just wanted to have you kind of talk about that a little bit. One of the two of you, please.
So Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Senator Taylor, great questions. We have the presentation set up to go over the monitoring program, both what we have currently and what we're seeking in policy option packages right at the end of the AIR program. What we were trying to do was just sort of lay some groundwork on state of the environment and what some of the problems are first, and then come back. If you'd like, we can go into that right now. It's really at the committee's pleasure.
It's the chair's decisions, of course, but I just was wanting folks to realize that we have a problem. There's a gap, as I understand it, and but I'll leave it to the chair to decide what to do.
Thank you. Right now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to continue through. I know that Senator Girard has something that he needs to get to, and I want to make sure that he gets some questions in at some point there, too. So if you don't mind us moving along here, let's see what we can do. I think you have some of the answers to that later on in this presentation. But we only have 25 minutes officially to deal with that for today. We'll be coming back tomorrow.
So Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Senator Taylor, we'll certainly hit this at least at a high level, and then, of course, we can follow up with you in detail as well. But we will be coming back to this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With that, and again, with the frame that we're trying to look at the overall state of the environment in terms of air in the state of Oregon, we're now shifting gears, and I want to talk briefly about greenhouse gas emissions. So the next few slides are on that subject. And as you all know, the Oregon legislature back in the 2000s set goals for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And the first goal was in 2010 to stop the growth in greenhouse gas emissions and begin to reduce emissions. Mm-hmm. The point of this slide is, although we were looking like we were making pretty good progress through about 2012, since that time, greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon have started to tick up again. So transportation greenhouse gas emissions, it's about 37% of the total greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. They're increasing slightly slower in transportation than the overall increase. But when you really start to break down the data on where the increase is coming from, for transportation in particular, a lot of that increase is coming from diesel. So not entirely from freight, but a lot of it from freight traffic. That's where we're seeing quite a bit of increase in greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in transportation. So I want to briefly,
the question I have is, you always monitor greenhouse gas trends in transportation, but the biggest greenhouse gas emitter in this state is forest fires. So why are we not monitoring forest fires as greenhouse gas emitters, since that's the biggest greenhouse gas emitter we have?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, and Senator Girard, it's a fair point, and I think you may know that the Oregon Global Warming Commission just completed, not long ago, its report to this legislative assembly. And one of the main pieces of work that they have been doing and are not quite done yet with is looking at the long-term greenhouse gas emission effects of forest fire and forest health. And I think there are going to be some important conclusions coming out of that work that we're going to need to talk about. So I don't want to minimize this issue in any way. The potential emissions from Oregon forest are enormous, if not properly managed. And so I think this is an important part of the overall conversation about greenhouse gases.
Just yes, to throw another tidbit in, one big forest fire can equal all gas emissions for 5 years. So, I mean it can be big.
Please, Chair. Oh, sorry, yes, Representative Esquivel.
From my colleague from the Senate, to add on to what he's saying, when we had the Biscuit Fire, which was, of course, almost the size of Rhode Island, we were told in our committee that the burning was the equivalent of everyone in the state of Oregon driving their car for 10 years. But the sad part was is the decay of the wood product afterwards was the equivalent of everyone driving their car in Oregon for 100 years. Now that's staggering because we did no salvaging.
So, committee members, I would like to take you quickly through the key performance measures for the AIR program. So the first is just the percentage of air contaminant discharge permits that are issued within the target for time of processing. We're a bit below target, but basically the trend is fairly flat here. So this is an area where there's a little bit of concern in terms of permit backlog in the agency, but not too significant. The next key performance measure is on quantity of diesel particulate emissions, and I'm just going to try to run us through these quickly,
okay,
if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So here, first of all, I want to point out the bars on the bar graph here, the bars that are in solid blue are actual years where we have measured emissions. The other light blue bars are just trend lines. So we do see diesel particulate emissions coming down in Oregon. That's very encouraging as we get cleaner diesel into the state, but we still have a ways to go in terms of meeting our KPM. And on this key performance measure 9A, this is looking at the number of days where we have unhealthy air conditions in the state of Oregon. And this is very much to the point that Representative Esquivel and Senator Girard just made. One of the main drivers here in terms of number of days of unhealthy air conditions is forest fire. That's one of the main drivers here in terms of the variation from year to year. And I'm sorry, this 9A was for sensitive groups, and then 9B is unhealthy for all groups. Really just the same point in terms of a lot of variation between years depending on fire, largely on fire conditions. In terms of this performance measure, it's looking at long-term trends in air toxics in large communities. You saw some of the detail on this in the presentation earlier. And again, it's essentially a good news story overall that we are seeing long-term in our larger communities a gradual decline in air toxics, but we are still significantly above benchmarks. And we really don't have great levels of information on this either. We have the one long-term trend monitoring site in Portland, another long-term trend monitoring site in LeGrand. So the information here is spotty. And then same thing really in smaller communities. Looking at timeliness of permit issuance for the larger facilities, Title V is the federal Title V of the Clean Air Act. It tends to be the larger, more complex facilities. And you'll see that we're actually hitting benchmark in terms of timeliness of issuance of those permits right now. So now, Dave, I am going to turn it back to you, if you don't mind, to talk a little bit in more detail about the programs that are within this part of DEQ.
Sure. Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, again, David Collier, DEQ. So I hope that you can see that our work really covers a pretty wide range of issues and complexity. And we also work with a really wide range of people and interests, ranging from individual homeowners and vehicle owners to assisting small businesses and working with major industrial facilities and working with stakeholder and neighborhood groups and the public. And we collaborate across the state with federal and state agencies and elected officials and tribal nations. So our staff is really engaged on a wide spectrum of issues of complexity and interest to people. Just a couple of numbers that I'll hit because I realize time is short. We're currently overseeing about 2,600 industrial source permits. That's for both large and small sources. Last year, we responded to more than 3,100 air complaints from the public taken through our public complaint system. And as I've mentioned, we work with several communities around the state all the time on dealing with their non-attainment issues, either helping them come back into compliance or avoiding a problem in the first place. Next slide. This is just an example of the type of data we put on our website to the public, and it just shows year to year how our air is, and ranging from good to unhealthy to hazardous. You can see that 2016 was a really good year. Sometimes that's depending on weather. Sometimes weather is helpful for air quality. Sometimes when we have cold, stagnant days in the winter, it's weather can turn against us and increase pollution. And of course, as you can see, some of the most extreme spikes we see in this data can show up through wildfires. Again, we deal with air pollution problems that range really from regional scope across state boundaries sometimes, like ozone or haze, to localized problems in communities or neighborhoods. Fortunately, I think one of the benefits that we see is that many of our strategies have benefits for multiple pollutants. For example, a wood stove strategy reduces both fine particulate and air toxics. So I think it's just really good to recognize that when we do an emission reduction strategy for one pollutant, like particulate or ozone, we often get a co-benefit and reduce other types of air pollution, like air toxics, at the same time. So sometimes, often, our strategies can pack a big punch.
Okay. With that, committee members, we're going to turn to talking about several of the policy option packages that are proposed in the governor's recommended budget. The first is Package 110, which is maintenance, really, of staffing levels for our basic air contaminant discharge permit program. Without getting into all the budget details, we would lose essentially four positions that we can't afford to keep paying for under the current fee level. Last fee increase was in 2013, and that has been sort of the expectation that we're doing this on a four-year cycle for these fee increases. The next package is Package 112, and this package is to put two staff people in place to respond to complaints from communities. The bar graph that you see in the lower right-hand corner shows you the number of complaints that we're seeing in the AIR program over time, with the left-hand side being 2012 and the right-hand being 2016. We've frankly had just an enormous spike in the number of complaints about air quality issues. Right now, we have zero dedicated staff to respond to complaints. Basically, when we get a complaint from somebody, we are taking somebody off working on a permit and trying to get them out in the field. So we're taking time. That creates several problems. One, we're taking time away from work on permits, but maybe more importantly, that person typically is not getting out in the field in a timely way. And by the time they do get out in the field, it's difficult to document any particular issue. So this proposal is to bring two people on board specifically for this purpose. Package 115 is a package that is implementing the settlement that was entered into between the federal government, a number of states, and Volkswagen over improper devices in diesel engines in Volkswagen cars. And so Oregon, the share of that the settlement is broken into several parts. One part of the settlement is to compensate vehicle owners. One part of the settlement is to mitigate for the diesel emissions that have occurred because of the improper equipment that was on the cars. So this is the mitigation portion of the settlement. Oregon, under the formula in the court settlement, is entitled to roughly $73 million in settlement funds. This would be the first installment of the settlement. And without going into a whole lot of detail, the basic proposal that Governor Brown expects to put forward, and that we will, I think, be talking in more detail with the policy committees about, is to use a significant portion of the settlement to make sure our school buses are clean. That's where we have a captive population of children who are being exposed to pollutants that we would like to take care of sooner rather than later. The other portion of the funding would be used for a competitive program where the dollars would be distributed based on essentially bang for the buck in terms of reduction in diesel pollution. Okay. So with that, we now come to the Cleaner Air Oregon program, where I want to describe the program very briefly. This is the Industrial Air Toxics Program, and then I want to talk about the policy packages in terms of monitoring resources that we're seeking as well. Again, at a very high level, we've had a longstanding federal program for control of air pollution, similarly a longstanding state program. The programs have been what's called technology-based. They require certain industries to have the best available control technology in those industries. And choices were made about which industries to regulate based on very high-level estimates of risk to health. What we have not really focused on as a nation is localized impacts of sources on the people right around particular sources. There is a federal air toxics program which has regulated air toxics to some degree, but again, looking at the very localized effect as opposed to area-wide effects, that's a gap that exists in our program. And that's what the Cleaner Air Oregon effort is intended to address. So we are in the middle of a pretty lengthy process to work with a broad range of stakeholders and the public putting this program together. The Legislative Assembly in the short session approved some significant general fund dollars to start this effort and for some monitoring associated with this issue. We are expecting, we're in the middle of a Rules Advisory Committee process right now, and we will have the very high-level starting point for talking about what this program consists of will be coming out in the next few weeks and will be discussed at the Rules Advisory Committee meeting for the first time in early April. And I know, we're probably going to be doing some briefings for policy committees on this program. The goal here is to have the program operational by the spring of 2018, and it will permit some number of sources where we have the highest public health risk from those sources. This is very much a health-driven program in partnership between the Department of Environmental Quality and the Oregon Health Authority. We're also working with local partners, Lane Regional Air Protection Agency, as well as local governments, public health agencies, and community interest, all participating in this, along with the federal government as well. So turning to the package here, package first package I want to talk about is package 116. This is the staffing associated with the Cleaner Air Oregon Industrial Air Toxics Program. And again, we have some adjustments in this package that we have been working with LFO staff on that I want to just apprise everybody about at a high level. We have another roughly 10 months of work to do in standing this program up, and before we get the rules before the Environmental Quality Commission. We also have outstanding emissions inventory requests that have been made to all the air permit holders in the state of industrial air permit holders in the state of Oregon. We won't get all of that information back until September of this year. So to be direct with the committee, we aren't going to really know for sure how many facilities we are going to be likely permitting in order to get to a particular risk level until we get those emissions inventory data back later this year. So recognizing that, what we have been talking with stakeholders about for the past month or so has been to shift gears a little bit here a little bit and move forward with a fee request, but only as a one-time assessment for the remaining work to stand this program up between now and July 1 of 2018, and to come back to the 2018 short session when we know how many facilities we're talking about, and to work with the legislature in the 2018 session to right-size the fee request for the continuing fees necessary to operate this program. I can't stand before you today and honestly tell you we know how many facilities are going to be in this program yet, so it's just, it's not ripe yet. But we do have specific numbers that we have worked with the health authority on regarding the need between now and the beginning of 2018 for what's needed to stand up the rest of the rulemaking effort. So with that, quickly, I know Senator Taylor is particularly interested in this package. This is the monitoring package request associated with this program. And essentially what this package would fund would be, first of all, the addition of six new trend sites for air toxics around the state. Those are similar to the two sites in Portland and the Grand that have been spoken to already. It also would provide nephthalometers, which are used to measure fine particulate, is essentially an early screening device for where we have localized issues, and equipment and staff for follow-up monitoring associated with this program. What it frankly doesn't provide is monitoring associated with response to concerns at particular facilities. We have some capacity that was provided in that regard in the 2016 session, but again, until we know we have the emissions inventory data and have a better idea of how many facilities we may be dealing with, it seemed to us a little bit premature to be coming forward with that part of the request at this time. So there is still a gap here in the request. I want to acknowledge that we'll have to look at as this program moves forward in program development. And with that, I've got to just leave you a little bit of time for questions.
Are there any questions? Yes, Representative. Yes,
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. How long have we had these toxic air toxic monitoring stations? When did we first put those in?
We've had the long-term trend monitoring sites in the state for quite some I'm sorry, Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel. We've had the long-term monitoring sites in place for quite some time. We'll get back to you with a specific answer.
Was that just in Portland and LeGrand?
Yes, Co-Chairs, Representative Esquivel, that's right.
And what
What brought that on?
Co-Chair Frederick, Co-Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, I believe, at least in part, that long-term monitoring was under the federal air toxics program.
Representative Taylor, did you have anything?
I'm good for now. I think we're time sensitive. Yeah.
Anyone else? Yes, Representative Power.
For package 112, if the two staff were added to help respond to complaints, do you have the existing staff to manage the complaint investigation process and resolution?
Co-chairs, Representative Power, you know, it's a bare bones package in terms of these staff would go out and perhaps do some, sort of spot. I can't tell you exactly what the type of monitoring is, but some early screening that then could lead to further follow-up. But then we're into essentially the Cleaner Air Oregon program potentially and looking at other types of monitoring.
Any further questions? We will begin tomorrow with a discussion, I think, of water quality.
That's correct.
Okay, and so bring your questions. I'm going to close today's hearing on SB 5518, and we will open up again tomorrow afternoon. Thank you again. We are adjourned, and I'm going to close this particular session.
Oh yeah,
here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All in one whack.
Oh yeah,
here.
Yeah. Thank you.
All in one whack.